I think this is the largest group I've seen in one of these meetings. Raise your hand if you're in the tent. Okay. Got it? Okay. That doesn't explain everything. I'm the attorney. So, welcome, and we do have a packed agenda. I have to say, these meetings are probably some of the most substantive meetings in the city on the Anacostia River. I think some of our outside advocates would agree to that. So, along those lines, as many of you know, that Gretchen here is our point person for DOEE, for a river, for the Anacostia, and she's in touch with many of you in putting this agenda together. This year is a critical year. We're kind of trying to put everything together in a way to get to the record of decision by June of 2018. And while we've had discussions, some angst, some concerns about that deadline, it's still the legislative deadline by the City Council. That has not changed. So with that in mind, I guess we should probably do introductions just so everybody knows who's in the room. And Gretchen, we'll start with you.
Gretchen McKeska, Anacostia Coordinator at DOEE.
Good morning. I'm Doug Siglin, Executive Director of the Anacostia Waterfront Trust. I'm sitting in this chair and replacing Mayor Williams as the co-chair.
Good morning, I'm Stephanie Hunt. I work for the Johnson Company, and I'm here on behalf of the National Park Service.
Fred Pinckney, Fish and Wildlife Service.
We're going to the back.
Jeff Johnson, Department of the Interior for the National Park Service.
Kelsey Rosenfeld, Assistant General Counsel here at DOEE.
Maureen Holman, Sustainability Chief, DC Water.
Steve Walls, Director of Environmental Programs at the Council of Governments.
Cindy Mahan with NOAA Office of Response and Restoration.
Great.
Mark Shue, Project Manager with DetraTech in support of DOEE.
Great.
Diane Evers, I'm the Acting Northeast Branch Manager for NOAA's Assessment and Restoration Division.
Tara Morrison, Superintendent at Anacostia Park, National Park Service.
Bill Matuszewski with the Alliance for the Chesapeake Bay.
Hi, I'm Tim Wilson from the U.S. Geologic Survey.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to WebEx. Enter your access code or meeting number followed by pound. Enter your attendee ID number followed by pound.
I'm sorry, Matthew with PEPCO, King R.I. at this project, Massachusetts.
Do we have all the principals around the table?
If there's any council members, leadership council members, please come to the table and you can grab your name tag if you see it. It's there somewhere. But if not.
And we've got more chairs around here. I'm going to sit right next to Gretchen.
But you can sit. There's one right there.
We've got room here. Gretchen, you can go down a little bit.
Yep.
All right. Come on in, Michael.
Thanks, Ron.
All right. All righty. So, as the director explained, we have another packed agenda. And when we come up with these agendas, we have a small working team that basically discusses what some of the issues that are important to the Leadership Council members, and then, of course, us on the project are cognizant of what is sort of the timely issues. And so what we decided to do on this meeting was we've been long awaiting the results of the tributary study. So we have Dr. Wilson presenting that first. And then what we're going to do is, because there's other active sites along the river, the conversation has been how are the remediations that are going at these other sites going to coordinate with the Anacostia River Sediment Project. So what we decided to do is basically walk down the sites over the course of a few meetings, probably. So at this meeting, we'll have PEPCO discussion of what the current status is, and APRVA will, our DOE remedial project manager, will present that. And then we have Washington Gas, which is where the lead agency is, the Park Service. So we have Stephanie Hunt from their consultant, the Johnson Company, presenting that. So when we talk about these sites along the river, what we'll do is we'll have the lead agency presenting the presentation for those sites. So we're going to start with Dr. Wilson. And okay.
Gretchen, while I'm up, let me just say that we do appreciate, at least I know I do and I think others do, your response to this effort to try and understand what else is going on along the river. And I think the absence of that at previous meetings was something that a number of people were mentioning, and you've been extremely responsive in a matter of weeks putting this together. So we're very much appreciative of this and looking forward to the next session. So.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, good morning, and thanks for inviting me to speak and tell you about what we've been doing for the last year and a half now, the small tributary studies to the Anacostia. I'm from the U.S. Geologic Survey, and there are several people that have been helping in this, so I want to make sure to acknowledge them. And our role here is to determine the sediment and contaminant loads in the tributaries that flow into the Anacostia. So we have two main objectives, and that is first to determine the loads of sediment and organic contaminants that come in Northeast Northwest Branch, Lower Beaver Dam Creek, Watts Branch, Hickey Run. This is for PCBs, PAHs, pesticides, and metals, and we do this through large volume sampling of suspended sediment. And then the second goal is to provide reasonable and realistic representative concentrations of sediment and contaminants in four of the small tributaries, Nash Run, Pope's Branch, Fort DuPont Creek, and Fort Stanton Creek. I'm sure we all know where these are, northwest, northeast, up. Hickey, Lower Beaver Dam, Watts. The small tributaries I'm talking about today are down in southeast Washington. One of the first things we did was we installed a USGS gauge station on Lower Beaver Dam Creek, which is outside northeast and northwest branch, probably the largest discharge, tributary discharge to the Anacostia. We put in a pretty sophisticated side-looking Doppler measurement system. Here are two employees doing the cross-channel calibration. And I've been told that next week we'll have the discharge, stage discharge curve completed. So now we'll know how much water and sediment come down this tributary. We've made over 120 calibration measurements. The discharge is incredible. We've got up to like 745 CFS. The stage will go from less than a foot to 5, 6, 7 feet in just a matter of minutes after storm. The five main tributaries, we've sampled winter, spring, and summer storms. And we've also sampled all of these main trips for low flow. So we have left to do is storms, fall storm, on these main trips, and one more round of low flow sampling. Not only do we do the chemistry samples that I'll be talking about, but we also, every time a storm happens, we try our best to collect sediment and carbon samples over the storms so that we can develop models for that relate discharge and turbidity to suspended sediment and POC. We have quite a number of storms finished. Here's just an example of one. This is a storm back on March 31st at Hickey Run. The blue line here is the gauge height. It goes along almost. This is just an example of one of our sampled storms. This is for Hickey Run. The gauge height, it starts raining and almost immediately the gauge, the stage goes up and you get several pulses as you stormwater discharge comes in. The black line is turbidity, or a measure of the suspended sediment in the stream, and you can see that there are pulses of sediment that come down. This is very typical with an urban flashy stream. The red line shows the interval in which we were able to get a sample. And our samples are 75 liters, a big tub of water that we collect. And we try to get as much sediment as possible. The more sediment we get, the lower our detection limits for some of these organic compounds. We were hoping to get 10, and we've been doing really well. We've been getting 40, 50, 60 grams of sediment per storm, so really good detection limits on that. As an example here, the total discharge for this one little storm was 12.7 million gallons. Our sampled interval represented 98% of that. So we really did well. That's a lot of luck, because it's very difficult to catch these flashy streams like this. Get enough sediment, get the sediment.
Right.
We collect.
I don't know how to do it.
It's early in the storm where the peaks come in.
It's okay for now.
And so we worked it out pretty well. Okay, so we get these big tubs of water, 75 liters. We bring them back to our lab, and then we filter the sediment out. These big plate filters. Each stream, you'll get these different colors, different consistencies to the sediment. As I said, we're doing really well. We get 40, 50, 60 grams of sediments in a storm. For our low flow samples, we just take the whole process out to the field, and we'll sit by the side of the river, and we'll pump 1,000 liters for about 6 hours, 7 hours, through a canister filter and a flat filter, and that's where we get our low flow samples from. Well, we've sampled the big rivers. We just have the fall storm left to do. And this summer, we've been working on these small tributaries, Pope's Branch, Nash, Fort Stanton, Fort DuPont. And these are extremely flashy. I mean, 20 minutes, you'll get a flow in 20 minutes, and it'll be done. So here's an example of Fort DuPont, little tiny streams, maybe a foot or two across. It rains, they go up several feet, and then the water drops. So we have Nash Run, Pope's Run, Fort DuPont Creek, Fort Stanton. We've caught low flow at two Nash, and we were able to get storms at three of these. We resampled Fort DuPont because, as I'll explain, show you in a minute, there's so much sediment comes down Fort DuPont, and we just did not believe that our first sample was representative, so we went back, the same thing happened, and so we got pretty good assurance we got a good sample. As I said, it's very difficult to sample these little streams. This is a hydrograph for Fort DuPont, And the red line is precipitation. The next station over at Hickey Run, almost a half an inch of rain. And that stream had a storm flow that was only 2 hours. So we had like 2 hours of intense discharge to collect our 50 or 60 grams of sediment. Very difficult. If you're not right there, ready to go, we've got all this worked out. It's working great. And we are able to catch these little storms. I mean, these little streams. Here's some pictures. Here's Pope's Branch. It's just a little meandering stream that comes through the city, empties into that big culvert, goes under the highway, and then out into the Anacostia. That's at low flow. And then we sample the storm. And the storm came at night. We had our trailer parked there with all our equipment. We got a great sample. We show up the next day, and it must have been just a raging, incredible torrent of water, because there's signs the water was all the way up to the road. This big log came down, wiped out just an amazing amount of water came down in that one storm. Here's Fort DuPont up the hill towards the park. This is dry, and I don't know if you can see, but there's just a little trickle of water, and that water is basically groundwater seeping out of the side of the hill. So that's low flow. Here down by the CSX yard, half an inch of rain, the water goes up a foot or two, and it is just thick with mud. It looks like the Mississippi River during a winter snowmelt flood. I mean, it is just thick with sediment. So much sediment, I've never seen as much sediment. Okay, so what have we found so far? And I have to put this disclaimer in here. All this data are provisional. The USGS has a really strict policy about presenting results before they've been checked over and peer reviewed, but I'm willing to show them today to you. These are provisional. I've still got a lot of blank work to do. And again, the goal here is to determine loads of contaminants, so still a lot of work to do. I hope to have this done by the end of this year. So what did we find? Here are the five main tributaries. These are the concentrations of total PCBs in low flow. And this is the minimum and the maximum in the storms that we've caught. This is one low flow sample and three storm events. Okay? First thing you notice is the low flow concentrations, total PCBs, are much higher than you find in the storm. And that's what we expect. That's what we found up in New York, New Jersey work. Because what we sampled during the low flow are basically the finest, the tiniest particles of sediment, clays, and organic carbon. And those are the materials that actually sequester and transport the contaminants. During the storms, you get sand and gravel and larger particles mixed in there that don't really have associated contaminants, and so it dilutes the concentrations out. The maximum conjugers, they're usually coalitions of three or four different PCBs. There are 209 PCBs. You don't get all PCBs off the chromatogram. You get these coalitions. And you can see these are the typical concentrations, about 0.1 to 0.2, maybe 3 or 4 micrograms per kilogram, the highest concentrations. Okay, next one.
Why is that data the same for 3 or 4?
I'm sorry, what?
Why is that data the same for 3 of those streams? The storm maximum.
Storm maximums?
No, the next column.
Oh, these are the that's the congener group that has.
In between column, you've got 129, 130, 160, 163.
Oh, these are the congeners. Okay, 129, 138, 160, 163. So yes, this stream, and this stream, the highest conjugate concentration are the same, these coalitions. Why is that? I don't know at this point.
Hey, Bill, we have like 209 congeners, right? So what you're seeing are the numbers represent those numbers, right?
So it's not the concentrations.
Not the concentration. The last column is the average concentration.
These all collude at the same time, and you can't tell from the chromatogram which individual PCB or PCBs add to that. But it is interesting, it's the same concentration. It's like PCB11. PCB11 is a dye. Anything that you see that's got that neon yellow has got PCB11 in it, including the paint that they mark parking lots with, yellow paint. So you often find PCB11 at really high levels in sediments. But we'll see what we find. Total PAHs, again, the concentrations in the low flow can be very high, 189,000 at Hickey. And the concentrations in the storms, again, three storms, one low flow, are always much lower. If you look at the individual PAHs, there's 27 of them, Lower Beaver Dam, Watts, Northeast Branch, and Northwest Branch. The three PAHs that are there in the highest concentrations are fluorinthine, benzofluorinthine, and pyrene. They're all similar. When you get to Hickey, you get these alkylated naphthalenes, which is indicative of oil and gasoline and hydrocarbons. We've gotten only one storm sample back of pesticide concentrations, and very few hits in our samples. But we did find these compounds, chlordane, DDE, aldrin, and these are the concentrations of those hits. Okay, there are 14 different pesticides. Again, we only found evidence of a few, but we've only got one storm. So what's next? Well, we've moved our equipment over to Fort Stanton, and we were hoping that Jose would come up the coast and give us a storm, but thank goodness it stayed off. We're ready for the storm, and then we'll have these four tributaries, small tributaries, finished. We're going to do Lower Beaver Dam, Northeast. Well, we're doing all the big tributaries one more time for low flow to get another round of pesticides and PCBs in these streams. And then this fall, we're going to do all the tributaries again for our final storm. And hopefully have this all wrapped up by the end of the year. The sooner the better, if you ask me. Storm sampling is not easy. So. Okay, some recommendations. These are recommendations I made to the DOEE. We've got a lot of work done. And if you do this work, you can see places that probably need some more effort. One of these is resampling these small streams for storms. We're going to wait until we see what comes back, but it's never really good to hang your hat on just one sample. It would be really... The other reason is, if you go out and you look at these streams during a storm, it's an amazing amount of sediment come down these streams. Amazing amount. And it's washing off the streets, it's washing out of the sewer systems, whatever, storm systems. It's eroding the hills. And to me, it's just one of the most amazing things I've learned from this adventure is how much sediment comes in these city streams. We're going to continue this discrete sampling at these larger streams. Lower Beaver Dam, we have a very good model for sediment in the northeast and northwest, so we don't really need to spend more money there, but this whole idea of modeling loadings is really predicated on being able to have a good model of discharge versus sediment. And then you assign a concentration to the sediment. The better that model is, the better the outcome of the modeling program for the Anacostia. So we're going to continue this discrete sampling. The equipment's all there. You just need to keep catching every storm you can. At the same time, we're going to continue making discharge measurements at these small streams. And that's, again, very difficult because they may only flow for 20 or 30 minutes. So you have to be there when it starts raining to get a discharge measurement. So we'd like to continue that. And then one that I'm really passionate about is continue at Lower Beaver Dam Creek. More samples, more storm samplings for the organic chemistry, because I feel like that's going to be a real key in all of this track down of contaminant sources and cleaning up the system. So,
okay, we're going to keep people. We're going to stay. You're good. No, stay up there. We've allotted some time for questions. This is the time probably to be as broad as possible on the questioning so that everyone can work through this. Yes, Fred?
Tim, can you just explain for a minute sort of how you deal with the tidal influence at Lower Beaver Dam?
We have a gauge. One of the first pictures I showed you was that the field crew out with the ADVM. We have an acoustic Doppler side looker, and what it does is it measures the velocity and the direction of the stream flow. Unlike a normal gauge system, which just measures the height of the water and relates height to discharge, this relates velocity of the water in a direction to discharge.
Okay.
So what we found is that there is no upward flow. What happens is the Anacostia rises because Potomac rises, the water just kind of backs up, stops, and even though it'll go up two or three feet every tidal cycle, it's not until you get a rainstorm that you actually get a big pulse of water down.
Okay, more questions? All right, great. Thank you very much.
Glad to help answer any questions you have.
All right, are you going back out in the field now? Going to go?
Like
get on
to.
One of those streams. It's a pretty day.
It's a nice day. It's nice.
All right, Gretchen. Anacostia River Sites Review.
Okay, let's see if I can go. Okay, so actually these slides you've seen before. Because when we first, in December, I think for the Park Service, the Johnson Company ran through our walk down the river of the sites. And that's when we started thinking about, okay, how is the Anacostia River Sediment Project going to take into account all these other consent decrees and potentially contaminated sites along the river? So Johnson Company did that review. I'm just going through this briefly for those of you who might have not been at that meeting, and I can remind you that you can also pick up these slides in our administrative record and also on the OpenDC website, so you can go back to those slides. So the sites along the river, we have the Kenilworth landfill, and this is basically upstream to downstream. PEPCO, that Apurva Patel will be talking about today. Washing Gas, where we have Stephanie Hunt talking about today. Navy Yard, the JBAB, Poplar Point, CSX, Southeast Federal Center, and then we also put on this our combined sewer overflows from DC Water. So as we know, our familiar map, going from the top, upstream, downstream, or these sites. So we've divided these into active sites and inactive sites. And basically, most of them are active sites. We have the Kenilworth Park landfill, that's 130 acres, north and south. NPS is the lead on that. We'll be talking about that site probably at the next quarterly meeting in December, or maybe the one after that, because it will take us a while to get through these sites. We have operable units there for landfill, for the landfill, and also for groundwater. For PEPCO, DOEE is the lead, and as I mentioned before, that's the reason we're giving the presentation today. The lead agencies will give these presentations. So we have 77 acres there, and APRVA will give us all those details today on the current status. Washington Gas site is only 18 acres. And the National Park Service is the lead. There has been a remedial action there where they took 3 feet out of the soil, replaced that with topsoil. There's a reseeding operation going on that I'm sure Stephanie will review. And also there's been a lot of work this summer. I know Emily and I have seen them out pretty much all summer in the last end of August with taking sediment samples right in front of Washington Gas, because we both spend a lot of time, and I don't think Mr. Foster is here today, on the river, so we see that activity going on, and people ask us what's going on, so we can tell them because we sit in these meetings. Though it's not, in my case, this is not actually part of my job to tell my boat people what's going on, but everybody's very interested. The Washington Navy Yard Superfund site, 63 acres, there's been removal actions been going on there since 1996, and they are very close to coming up with their proposed plan, and we'll talk about that site in detail at one of the next meetings. And also JBAB has work going on, which is 1,018 acres. So there's two operable units there that are active for looking at basewide groundwater impacts and that impact to the river. The inactive sites, we have Poplar Point, which is actually now almost going to be an active site. We have to, the review of the special use authorization, which is basically the access agreement. NPS and DOE is now, our legal teams are looking at that. As soon as that's resolved, there are two work plans that have already been approved, and that is getting ready to go. And our friends at Tetra Tech will also be assisting on that site. DOEE is working on behalf of the district on doing the RI implementation there. CSX, 40 acres, they basically did their corrective action in 2015. They consider themselves at this point done, so not much work going on there, but APRVA is the RPM on that site, so she keeps tab on it when there is a need. And Southeast Federal Center is 55 acres. Their ROD was in 2015, so that is considered inactive at this point. So the point of all this is there's many of these selected remedies will be in the year of 2018. We have RROD, which is the June 29, 2018, Kenilworth Park Landfill, September 2018, the Navy Yard, October 2018. We have the Anacostia River Tunnel coming, planned to be online in March 2018, and that's on track or ahead of schedule, I understand. And the Washington Gas ROD is behind this, that's 2020. And all the documents for these sites are on the various websites for the lead parties, and additional documents can be picked up at these online access points. So with that, we have Mrs. Patel is next. Find you. Okay, I will try to follow you Okay. Just nod my way if I get behind or ahead.
So, good morning, everybody. You can go to the next one. This is a PEPCO's construct wavelength and the post photo. Most of the information in the beginning probably everybody knows, but I'm just going to repeat a few of the important things. In December 2011, DC Federal District Court approved the consent decree between District and PEPCO, and that recorded the PEPCO agreed to do RIFS for their property and the portion of the river in front of their property. DOE, on behalf of District, is overseeing PEPCO's work, and we solicit and consider public input throughout the RIFS process. In 2012, PEPCO and DOE organized and convened the community advisory group, and it different representatives are a part of the CAG. The CAG members include AWS, Riverkeeper, Groundwork, ANC members, and we meet PEPCO and DOE attend monthly CAG meetings, and we answer any concerns and we give updates regularly. We organize public meetings during various milestones. So far we had public meetings during RIFS work plan when it came out for the public review and comment period, then during the when the draft RI report came out for the public comment period. This is a little bit of background about the Benning Road facility. Benning Road facility is around 77 acres in the northeast portion of District of Columbia. PEPCO has operated at this location more than 100 years. PEPCO used to have a generating station, and but it has been shut down around in 2012, and all the associated structures has been already removed by 2015. Next. So as per the consent decree, the whole study area is divided into two parts. One is the land side, another one is the water side. The land side is the actual facility, and the water side is the right in front of PEPCO's property, around 1,000 feet up gradient from their main outfall, which is 013, which is this one, and then around 2,800 feet down gradient of the outfall. Next. The target contaminants for the remedial investigation are PCBs, PAHs, metals, dioxin, POCs, SVOCs, and pesticides. I can go over those in detail, but I think everybody knows all these chemicals. So now I will go a little bit of the RI phase one, what has been already completed. Based upon, they completed the work as per the approved RIFS work plan. And on the land side, they had the PEPCO identified the target areas based upon their historical and current use of that location, maybe potential impact from those locations. Maybe it was former transformer, underground storage tank, former cooling tower, which is right here. The sludge dewatering area, all those areas are like those in blue triangles, blue shapes. Those are the target areas. And then they collected the surface samples, subsurface samples. They installed monitoring wells, collected groundwater samples. That's all. This is the waterside sample location, and these locations got a little bit moved at the time of actual investigation. So this is from the work plan time. And then they collected surface samples, surface water samples. They collected the core samples up to 10 feet, around 10 feet deep. That's all. This just gives the summary of how many samples they collected. The surface soil, 25, around the cooling tower, which is actually already demolished, and they excavated around 8,000 tons of soil. They took it out offsite. They had installed 30 monitoring wells, shallow and deep monitoring wells. water side, they collected subsurface soil samples, subsurface sediment samples, around 208 subsurface sediment samples. These are the few of the RI data gaps which we identified, and those are being addressed currently. The second phase of RI investigation currently going on. Landslide investigation, we have identified higher PCB elevated concentrations of PCBs, dioxin, metals, and PAHs. And for the groundwater, it was PCE, perchloroethylene, MTB, PAHs, dioxin, and PCBs. And the waterside investigation, the main we identified was the PCB concentration was higher at the 013 outfall. There are more data gaps, but I'm just identifying only the few. Next one. We identified that they have to do additional forensics analysis because several contaminants were detected on site in the river sediments, which can be attributable to the other sources other than PEPCO. So in the second phase of investigation, they will be conducting they are conducting additional forensic analysis, and also they will be conducting expanded background investigation, so we can compare the on-site data and update the risk assessment. So this is the phase two investigation areas. The original target areas are the blue color, and they identified more target areas. Actually, PEPCO, after they finished the draft RI first phase, they went back and then they looked into more in the areas. They had interviews with the PEPCO employees and identified more target areas based upon whatever hits they had during the first phase of investigation. And few of those are in the corner, the yellow, which is chlorinated solvent area. Then this is the historical fueling station. So they will be investigating those areas. And also there were few hits in the existing target areas, which will be more characterized and delineated in the second phase. This is the water side, phase two investigation, the sample locations. During the second phase, they will be collecting for the biological testing, and also the green circles are the sediment stability analysis, which will give over the period what kind of impacts have deposited at these locations. That's the study they have collected. They collected three locations along the, one is the right in front of 013 outfall. This is the another outfall which PEPCO has, which is 101, which is west of Benning Road. This is completed. They have collected already the background forensic sampling locations, since it is a background which goes all the way up to Maryland, and the forensic analysis in front of PEPCO's the riverside area. So this is a project schedule. So the green color is already done, and currently we are at the RI phase two field investigation. So far we are as per the schedule, but this is getting little bit delayed for two reasons mainly. The one is the current investigation is done in the clear phase. Suppose for the first year, if we find the data shows it needs more characterization and delineation, then PEPCO and DOE, PEPCO shares data with us, we discuss, and then we come up with the additional locations. Then they have to apply for the permits, and they have to do the additional investigation. So it's kind of getting delayed. So we are almost in the third tier, right, Ravi? And so we are still waiting for the data for that, whatever they have got from the second tier. And the second reason is we have delays because of the permits. We have to get a lot of permits from Army Corps, MDE, DOE, and NPS. So there are delays because of the permits. So, and I'm not done.
Oops, sorry.
And then the next, the draft final RI report will come out for public review in March 2018. And then final RI report, May 2018. Feasibility study report, public review, May 2018. And the final feasibility report, July 2018. So as per the consent decree, is the RI report, the PIPCO has to submit RI report to DOE for review and comments within 120 days after completion of the fieldwork, and 180 days feasibility report after completion of the fieldwork. So far we are on the schedule. Done. Now currently what we are doing. So as I said already, we are doing the second phase of field investigation. The water samples collection is completed in June 2017, but we are still waiting for the laboratory analysis, and the venting and toxicity studies is in progress, and then PEPCO and DOE will discuss the data. And right now we are reviewing background sampling results and the forensic results, which we are looking at their waterside data to decide which samples should be submitted to the lab, because PEPCO has collected cores and archive them. Based upon the data, we will approve which samples to be submitted for the forensic analysis. And then after we have resolved all the data gaps, the RI report is due to DOE in January 2018. And at the same time, initial planning is going on for the feasibility study. So when we are doing the PEPCO's project, we are continuously coordinating with our Anacostia River sediment project. The data is always shared with each other. Anacostia River sediment project data is shared with PEPCO, and PEPCO shares the data with us. So all that data is already on our database, the DOE's database. The second phase, PEPCO's data, will be shared again with DOE's database. DOE is constructing and calibrating groundwater flow and solute transport model to examine the fate and transport of the contaminants at the surficial aquifer, which we will be doing for all other potential environmental cleanup sites along the river, but we are starting with PEPCO. And then PEPCO's riverside feasibility study is coordinated. We are trying to coordinate with the Anacostia River sediment project, so everything happens at the same time.
Okay. Questions?
At a broad level, but you know, the coordination for PEPCO, where you're looking at things like background or fingerprinting, like it's probably for source attribution, you know, and there's probably a conceptual model as well for PEPCO in terms of, you know, the source and the migration pathways to the river at a more local scale than the broader conceptual model, you know, for the riverwide study. But, you know, I'm just curious if there's been much discussion yet in terms of, you know, how that fingerprinting is being done is compared to, like, say, how different sources and loadings are being evaluated for the riverwide study, and then, you know, and also for the background.
So the question is primarily PCBs or all the...
Primarily PCBs.
So the question is, to what degree are we doing fingerprinting for source identification of PCBs up and down the river, or just in this site?
For this particular site, you know, you mentioned fingerprinting. That could be a pretty detailed question, like how are you doing it? But, you know, then again, how is that interpreted relative to what's kind of fingerprinting in some senses? Like, you know, the stream stuff kind of had fingerprints maybe by looking at those congeners. You know, so that's probably the fingerprinting type of approach, but... You know, it's a very... I guess.
Can you answer that?
I think it's a little bit of attorneys, and I think it's a bigger question of the fingerprinting for the source and then connected to the...
Yeah, it's a technical issue too, though, not just the leader.
So that information is being shared with Tetra Tech, and Tetra Tech is doing the whole big picture. So that's fairly connected, right, Mark?
That's correct, Director. We are doing a forensic
analysis. We collected forensics data up and down the river, and we'll be looking at generating a urban fingerprint that can be used for PEPCO. I mean, they're doing an extensive fingerprinting of their own source material, and those two data sets could be compared to it, I think, the question you're asking.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, so fingerprinting of the source of PEPCO, is that like the sediments in the cove, or is that in the groundwater? Because like the historic, you know, the sources from the land side, I guess you mentioned there was a large removal. Was that for PCBs too? Or
yes, it was for the cooling tower PCBs.
You have some fingerprinting from that source material?
Yes, even from the land side, we have submitted, PEPCO has submitted the samples for the forensic on the land side too.
That's great.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Aperva. Thank you very much. Next, we've got Washington Gas, Stephanie Hunt, the Johnson Company, for the National Park Service. Stephanie?
All right, good morning. We'll be talking about the Washington Gas site. So the Washington Gas site is just upstream of the Navy Yard site on the other side of the 11th Street Bridge. You can see we have some outfalls along the site as well. So some background, Washington Gas manufactured gas from coal for lighting and heating from 1888 to the mid-1980s. They were not at full capacity during that entire time. From about 1948 until 1970, they only operated during periods of peak demand, and then from 1970 to 1983, they only operated once per year to check equipment. The wastes that were generated include coal tar, purifier box waste, wood chips, ash, cinders, and clinkers. Historical reports show that these wastes were occasionally placed as fill along the site. The contaminants of concern include PAHs, particularly naphthalene, VOCs, particularly benzene, cyanide, and heavy metals. And Washington Gas did perform voluntary cleanup actions under EPA oversight, and currently operates a pump and treat system that is designed to capture contaminated groundwater before it enters the river. So here we have an aerial photo of Washington Gas site in 1951. The area that was subject to the EPA cleanup is outlined in blue, and the government property is outlined in red. The government property is the parcel that is subject of the current investigation, and it's a 4.2-acre area.
So when you say government, D.C. government or federal
government? Well, it's land that was owned by the Park Service that is transferred to the district.
Okay.
And so it's 4.2 acres between the plant and the river. And you'll see that there are some various holders and tanks on the Washington Gas EPA cleanup property. All of those tanks, for the most part, were removed between, I think it's 1983 and 1986. With all above ground storage tanks related to MGP operations removed by 1997. And here is what the site looks like today. We have the Maritime Plaza and a parking lot in the EPA cleanup area, and they still do have a small treatment building for their pump and treat system. And then we have the government property as well. You can see all buildings are demolished. There's just one building left, and that's a old pump house. It's a historic structure. We have some boat clubs upriver at the property, and then you'll see that parcel kind of wedged between those two lower government property parcels, and that's an area controlled, owned by Army Corps of Engineers. All right, so in September 2012, a consent decree was issued for the government property. So again, that's just that 4.2-acre parcel between the plant and the river. Washington Gas is conducting the investigation under NPS and DOE oversight, and NPS is the lead agency under CERCLA. There are two operable units that are addressed in the consent decree, OU1 and OU2. OU1 is soil, OU2 is groundwater and impacted river sediments. For OU1, the remedial action is essentially complete. They're just doing some revegetation and monitoring for that. For OU2, the investigation is ongoing. So I'll start with OE1. The remedial action work plan was approved in September 2014. The remedial action included excavating the surface and subsurface soils to a maximum depth of 3 feet, backfilling with clean soil, and then reseeding for vegetation. The excavation of contaminated soil was completed in July 2015, and this picture in the lower right shows some of the soil that we find on site. You can see some black staining, maybe some ash in there, some cinders, and then at around 3 feet, we generally would encounter this clean-looking soil, just in terms of no odor, no visual impacts. In places where there were still some, you know, stained or smelly soil at 3 feet, we would place an indicator, bright orange indicator fabric down before backfilling with clean soil. So revegetation monitoring is ongoing. The performance standards for vegetation need to be met over 2 consecutive years. The first seeding event was October 2015, and the first performance evaluation was November 1st, 2016. During that evaluation, performance standards were not met. And because of that, we had some modifications to the seed list, and those were approved by NPS in March 2017. And then reseeding was completed last summer. The next performance evaluation will take place at the end of October this year. More. And that is what the site looks like after it's been revegetated. Go on. So we've completed quite a few activities for OU2 already, and that's again the groundwater and impacted river sediments. Mobilization one was soil borings, and that was conducted in December 2015. So we had 2 transects that we completed soil borings along. 1 transect was along the river, essentially from the 11th Street Bridge to the Boat Club property, and then we had another transect up towards Water Street. During that mobilization, we looked at the various geologic units. We typically found a couple feet of fill on top, followed by some organic clay. Beneath the organic clay interval, we had sand and gravel, and below that, we had the Arundel clay. We were looking specifically for any sand lenses or potential transport pathways in that organic clay unit, along with delineating the sand and gravel.
And this is in the river?
This is on land.
This is on land.
Mobilization 1 is soil borings on
land. Okay, got it.
And then mobilization 2 is hydraulic profiling, and that was completed in May 2016. That was again on land. We went back to areas where we had advanced soil borings, and where we wanted more information about the geologic units, hydraulic profiling can give us some relative hydraulic conductivities of the various units. It also allowed us to do grab groundwater samples for contaminant concentration. Mobilization 3 was well installation and groundwater study, and that was completed in December 2016. We used the information from mobilization 1 and mobilization 2 to determine the best locations to put wells and also the best depths to screen the wells. Mobilization 4 is the hydrographic survey, and that's in river, October 2016. So that was a bathymetric survey so that we could better understand where we want to collect sediment cores from in the next mobilization. So that's mobilization 5, the in river sediment investigation. And that took place in August 2017. So just wrapped up a couple weeks ago. So during that investigation, we collected sediment cores in the river from basically the 11th Street Bridge up to the Boat Club property. And we collected up to a maximum depth of 30 feet, I believe. And we also collected grab sediment samples from the top 6 inches. We collected beneath the river groundwater samples using temporary piezometers. And we also collected surface water samples at the locations where we also had the beneath the river groundwater samples. And we are still waiting on the data, but in general, based on visual and olfactory evidence, manufactured gas impacts were observed deeper and over a larger area than we had anticipated. And the bottom picture shows the sampling setup for the mobilization 5. We had a 100-foot barge, which is probably why there was so much interest in what was going on in the river, with a drill rig mounted on that, a tugboat to move the barge, and then a support vessel that would collect turbidity measurements and also would do sheen checks to make sure we were not releasing sheens during coring. And finally, activities to be completed. We have Mobilization 6, which is upcoming at the end of this month, hopefully. And that's an additional landside groundwater investigation. We have a couple data gaps that we want to cover up. And so we had some elevated benzene on the east side of the site near the boat club property. We want to kind of determine the nature and extent of that and potential source areas. And then we also had one location in the river where we had surface sediment contamination. And that was just outside of an outfall. So we're looking at whether that pipe bedding of the outfall could be a potential pathway for the contamination that we observed in the river. Once we have all of that data, the RI report will be drafted, and a draft is due August 2018. The feasibility study will also be due in 2018. However, if a treatability study is necessary, that would extend the completion date to 2020. Regardless of whether a treatability study needs to be completed or not, post-planned and record of decision will be completed by 2020. Questions?
Questions in the back, yes, sir.
On the OU1 study, you were advised on after you did the 1-year performance evaluation in November, mm-hmm. the performance standards were not met. Could you elaborate on that? Which were the performance standards
sure.
were not met?
So the performance standards were basically looking at how many of the planted species that were the desirable species were actually on the site. So we laid a transect and looked at what percentage of the plants that touched that transect were one of the planted species, one of the desirables, or an undesirable species. And they had to exceed a certain, maybe it was 75% or 70% or something like that, of desirable species along that transect, and that was not done. So we went back and looked at the seed list. They brought in another consultant, and we modified the seed list to hopefully have more success this year.
Mm-hmm. Right here.
I'm just wondering on timing. If the ride for the Anacostia River wide study is June 2018, right, mm-hmm. and Washington-Gayes sediments going to be 2020, how would that work? Would they just leave like a how would that work? I guess the 2018 rod wouldn't address the Washington-Gayes areas.
Ms. Hunt's not going to be able to answer that
yes.
for you, but that's kind of the, we all recognize that we have all this going on together. It's extremely important that we work together between the National Park Service and DOEE, that we not be the reason that anything else is slowed down or delayed, but at the same time we provide enough guidance so that going forward. Now each site is different, and so the just what Ms. Hunt was describing in terms of what they found 30 feet down is different what we found in some other areas. So part of our job is to be the orchestra conductor to try to make all this work together, and that's part of the presentation today. But that's exactly the question that prompted this agenda. Doug?
So what happens when the grass finally passes the test?
Well, then they'll go into just long-term monitoring. They'll have a 5-year monitoring report. I think that's due in 2019 or 2020. And that 5 years kicks off from the start of remedial action.
So another way to frame, if I understand where you're going, Doug, is to the National Park Service. Once the 2-year performance standard of vegetation is met, does that mean that the site can be activated within the guidelines of what can be used with that site?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the bike path can open, that comes.
And that can't happen before August of 2019. That's the earliest.
Well,
possible.
we're working on it.
But yeah, we are looking at how mm-hmm. can we open up that bike path that's been closed for a few years.
Yeah.
And allow, but still protect the site and allow access to those units. So that is something that we're discussing now.
Let me take that question a little bit further. When this is complete, I believe it's transferred to the district.
Yes,
it's already transferred.
Yes.
Transferred.
It's already transferred to the district. But you have control over remediation and all that. At what point is National Park Service somewhat out and that the district can plan for the use of that property? Jeff?
We're looking in these corners here.
As Stephanie pointed out, OU2 is going to be going on for some amount of time, so the Park Service will be involved at least in that limited role of ensuring that the investigation and the remediation are carried out properly. But beyond that, it's really going to be a limited monitoring role after OU2 remedies.
OU2, including the river sediment.
It's the river sediments and groundwater on the site itself.
So it would only be after the river sediment remediation has been dealt with would the land be available for some type of utilization beyond bike paths?
I think we'd have to know a little more about precisely what type of uses you're talking about, but the Park Service will have some involvement throughout the OU2 investigation.
Okay, so let's just put a pin in that for further discussion so we can help around the community expectations of utilization of that land, in particular while the Department of Deputy Mayor for Economic Development deals with the Boathouse Row. So we'll put just a pin in that. All right, more questions. We're going to do another round. Well, first, Dev had his hand up, right?
Yeah. For the sediments in the river, have you collected benthic samples?
Yes.
Do you have any data to share?
Yeah, I think they did have some preliminary data. Overall, I think the survival was good, but again, we've only received one table so far. We haven't gotten a good look at the data yet.
So how many samples did you collect?
Oh boy. What was it? 60 samples or so? 50?
Okay.
Something like that.
That should probably be more of a science to science conversation.
Yeah.
If that's, you know, with your client's permission,
yeah.
With DOE would be terrific. Question in the back.
Thank you. On OU2, in the discussion of mobilization five, the in-river sediment investigation, Pank Energy claims that the manufactured gas impacts were deeper and over a larger area than was anticipated. Can you amplify on that a little bit? What was the nature and extent of those impacts, and what are their implications for the overall remediation of the main stem?
Well, like I said, we haven't received the data yet, so I can't speak too much on that point, but the work plan for the in-river investigation included sediment sampling to 10 feet, and we extended that to 30 feet to give you an idea of what we were seeing.
Okay, I take it the results of that will, of course, be harmonized
yes.
with the results of the RIFS of the main stem, the meter measures of the integrated
sediment.
Mm-hmm. Doug?
You saw a little surface contamination, and there's an outfall implicated. Whose outfall is it?
Kathy,
The outfall that's in question actually belongs to UC Water. We believe that there's a hypothesis currently that the pipe bedding is acting as a conduit. So the next phase of work that Stephanie mentioned, mobilization six, we plan to go in and we're working with DC Water to get permission to test pit alongside that particular structure so we can get some visual observations and try to better understand how that pipe is acting.
And is that one a combined or a separate?
It is a CSO.
Yeah.
Is it the one on the south end of the property?
If you wanted to put the drawing,
do you know what
up,
number
it runs
is?
Parallel to the bridge.
Yeah.
I think it's 016.
11.
Yeah.
Wall Street Sewer 016.
Yes. I believe the number is 16 NPS 016.
Thank you.
And we've already been in touch with DC Water.
Okay, more questions? All right. Gretchen, let's talk about where we go from here. We build an agenda for the next meeting, and what else?
Well, we build an agenda for the next meeting. This meeting we've completed early. We're usually late. So one of the things we can do now is talk of some of our major initiatives. I know, you know, maybe either AWT or Park Service wants to talk a little bit about the year of the Anacostia, 2018. I know we've been working on that. So I think one of you should give a pitch on that and tell how our members can participate.
So good morning again, everyone. I think we're still in the morning. Tara Morrison, again, superintendent of Anacostia Park. We've been working closely and very excited about what we're terming the year of the Anacostia to celebrate the centennial of the park and the river, and also including in the year of the Anacostia, the bicentennial of the birth of Frederick Douglass. So in close coordination with Doug Siglin and AWT, as well as Jim Foster with the Anacostia Watershed Society and Scott Kratz with the 11th Street Bridge Project initially, and our group is ever expanding. Gretchen has joined us. And what we're looking to do is, starting in January, really not only celebrate a year of these significant anniversaries, but also looking at opportunities to engage communities along the river in efforts like this to understand, yes, it's important to celebrate the last 100 years, but how do we all need to be good stewards of the river and the park going forward for the next 100 years and beyond, and why all of the work that we're doing with these types of projects is critical and important. And from a Park Service perspective, when we're conducting particularly environmental assessments and other planning efforts, we're not planning for planning's sake. We know people are busy, but we want to do a better job in communicating with communities and helping them to understand why it's so critical for them to be involved in these projects as we move forward and do our jobs as managers of this land. Now, that's all the heavy stuff. We also want to have a lot of fun next year. So are looking for as many organizations and individuals to join us in that. We're not looking to host everything ourselves, but we'll be rolling out a campaign in November, inviting other organizations to work with us to plan these events and activities, both in the park and out in the community. Doug?
Let me just fill in three pieces quickly. That was a great overview. One is, just so people are understanding what this is fundamentally about, Congress in 1918, actually during World War I, passed a law that said that all of the land around the Anacostia that was being created by dredging and filling by the Corps of Engineers would be a public park. And that was a pretty visionary thing to do at the time, because there was a lot of fighting about what that land would become, and Congress said more than 1,200 acres of land, 600 acres of water would become public space, and that was a big deal. So we're 100 years later, so the impetus for this whole 2018 year of the Anacostia thing comes from that. And then you pile on to that a number of other things, the Frederick Douglass bicentennial, and the fact that we've got all these rods that are supposed to be done then, and the fact that the major tunnel system is coming online sometime during 2018, which is going to reduce bacteria by something like 98% when it's done, and the fact that DC Water is moving its headquarters down to this fantastic new building right along the park. It's a lot of stuff going on. So we're going to try to make this a big deal about the year of the Anacostia. Second piece, the council has some legislation teed up that the council will get involved in designating. It's a sense of the Congress, sense of the council resolution, but the council is actually going to designate 2018 the year of the Anacostia. And the third piece is, we're trying to work closely with the nationals to try to see how we can get some traction on this whole year of the Anacostia idea around the fact that the All-Star Game is happening at Nationals Park in July, and there's a whole series of events, I didn't know this, but there's a whole series of events, runs and rallies and VIPs events and all that sort of thing that's going to be happening during that All-Star Week. And so we're deep into conversations with the Nationals about how we can use that as an opportunity to really draw attention to the river. Thanks.
Let's see. I think Dr. Phelps is back there. Sure. You mentioned that you had an update you wanted to give.
You probably know
UDC, Flanagan University of DC, has been studying by the toxics in Anacostia by using something called active biomonitoring, which is a very effective way of seeing what's available, what's bioavailable. You know, stuff going by all the time, but it may not be bioavailable. And we mapped all the streams coming into the Anacostia upstream, east and west. And for example, we found Sligo Creek, a major source of chlordane. And chlordane is one of the biggest contaminants in the fish, toxic contaminants in the fish. You can only follow the bioavailability by using, finding out what's available to the biota. And that's by using something called active biomonitoring. It's used all over the place in Europe, but not here. And I don't care what you measure. If the fish don't see it, you really don't care about it. You know, that's in terms of biology. So this is a five conferences a year, including Paris and China. To talk about this issue through my research. And I know it's going to have to come up this year. And we can ID the sources. We can GPS the sources.
Okay, well...
So has that been done? Have we GPSed the sources on Sligo Creek? And what's your... And what's the conversation with Prince George's County?
Hasn't gotten anywhere. Or she's finally got around to reading the paper. No, these are legacy sources. There's nothing you can do about the sources. You can't see them anymore. They were dumped probably around 1980 and it's degraded chlordane. It's coming up. You know, it's degraded because heterochloroxide. There's only one undegraded site in town, and that's down near Proper Point. And I have no idea where that is, but that's something that's not been exposed to the elements, quote unquote, fresh. I don't know how to sample that, but as I've said many times, I'd be glad to consult you. And please contact me. You have my contact.
Yeah. And I know what we've, you know, all the data that you have collected, we've passed to Tetra Tech, and the risk assessors have taken it into account. And so more conversations are certainly welcome between the Tetra Tech risk assessment teams.
If you dig up sediment, you're going to release more than one.
Mr.
Changing hats now. I'm the vice chair of the Friends of the National Arboretum. Mm-hmm. And years ago, we began working with the city on the cleanup of Hickey Run. When we did that, it ended up in a multi-million-dollar facility right there in New York Avenue, the purpose of which was to remove toxins and trash. At that time, Hickey Run was the largest source of toxic contamination in the entire Anacostia watershed. The facility went in, had some problems with operation, had some problems with maintenance. The Friends of the National Arboretum and the Arboretum management, looking at the potential to clean up Hickey Run and restore it within the Arboretum. Seeing that situation, we decided to move over to Springhouse Run. And the city has supported, with EPA funds, the restoration of Springhouse Run, which is virtually complete at this time. And I encourage anybody who wants to go out there to really look at a spectacular job that was done. The plantings have not been done yet. The Garden Clubs of America have gone out and collected 6,000 native plants in the countryside. They are in the Arboretum greenhouses ready to put in. So there's a lot going on there. Now, having done that, the Arboretum and the Friends are now looking at, well, why don't we now go back to Hickey Run and restore Hickey Run within the grounds of the Arboretum? The report I hear today is that Hickey Run is still possibly the worst source of toxic contamination in the Anacostia. The numbers you're showing us up there, Timothy, were rather high numbers. And I'm wondering, is this something that is worthy of taking on at this point, or are there things that need to be done upstream in Hickey Run?
So the question actually then becomes, is this an agenda item or should we have a separate conversation on this? Because we have a substantial project going on with Hickey Run now. As you know, a lot of Hickey Run is underground. And we've been doing some wonderful robotics to determine sources of contaminants. And we do have a mid-project report, but I don't know whether to do it for this group. We have to decide if it's on this agenda or a separate one with Friends of the Arboretum. Deb, do you want to say anything about the status of that?
Or Jeff, maybe.
Or Jeff.
I think Jeff would give the status on that piece. Jeff, are you here?
I thought that was primarily with respect to sewage.
The CCTV, Hickey Run.
Other activities that are going on now?
I have to talk to Josh.
Now, I've spoken with Colin about it, and I know that that's the primary
work. A little bit of hint in terms of what's going on. I think they're using pretty much the same technique that we did for the Anacostia, which is to look for the manholes and then collect sediment samples where possible, and then analyze those to see what's coming in. And then a second thing would be to do the CCTV to understand the integrity of the structures to see if there are any problems with the pipe itself and collect some samples. So obviously, and then also put cameras, time series cameras to determine if there are any specific discharges coming during certain period of time. We've done a 24-hour cycle, and if you see the same discharges every day, night in the, from 12 to 2, there's a problem, right? So those are all a small indicator items that you use to understand, who are the question is, who is doing it? That's the second question. But the first thing is it happening? Yes. Then it goes back to the follow-up question, which is how and who's doing it. So
where we are, it's definitely Hickey Run CSI. And we will at any time come out to the Friends of the Arboretum and do a presentation of where we are at that moment in our investigation of Hickey Run. We have a major operation to get it cleaned up.
The question that I have is, my understanding was that operation was essentially to deal with illicit discharges of sanitary sewage into the system. What you're saying is broader than that now. It's going to deal with some of these numbers that tend to be out of there.
The thing here is, if you look at that tributary study that addresses not just the main five main tributaries, but also smaller DC tributaries, you want to understand the quantity of the sediments coming in from each of those tributaries and what are the loads coming in from those. Because obviously, you don't understand what's coming in from each of these trips to make up that total 100% mass, you can't. You can't remediate. You know that there's a problem at one or two segments of that whole system there. So that's the reason why we are doing systematically in terms of each of the investigations, and then depending on the final results and outcome, we're going to evaluate and see whether or not are there any more missing links that we need to address those. So I think that will be part of the study.
Just be aware of the public. The public out there is ready to go, and they think they've got a big win on their hands with Springhouse, and they're ready to turn their
attention. No question. If somebody, it's always nice to visit our United States Arboretum, but now is the time to see what stream restoration looks like. This is really God's work out there. It is gorgeous, the stream restoration out there. Dr. Phelps?
If you run plans to bear the highest PAH in the entire system. Hickey Run is formed by runoff from Route 50. I suggest that is a major source. Mm-hmm. What do you do about Route 50? I don't know.
Fred?
I just wanted to mention to the group, actually playing off the last couple comments, first as for UDC, Director Wells has been there and East Capitol Urban Farm just had an influx of about 200 volunteers led by a veteran group called The Mission Continues. And last Saturday did a very extensive renovation of this 3-acre Urban Farm right next to the Capitol Heights Metro, and UDC Causes, their agricultural group, is the lead organization, and apparently there's a functioning aquaponics facility there. That same group, the mission continues on October 28th, is going to work on renovation of the Washington Youth Garden in the Arboretum. I think it's from 9 to 3:30, and there's some really interesting people of the veteran group there, as well as anybody is open to come, and so I can pass the contact information on to the group.
Thanks, Fred.
Well, for the project, we're kind of in what we'll say crunch time, because we are working very diligently on the feasibility study. So right now, the FS is supposed to be, the schedule is to be posted for public comment in January 2018. So that's what we're heading towards right now. And we'll have a public meeting around that time to basically make the public aware that it's posted. We welcome their comments, get any initial impressions. We don't exactly know the timing of that meeting yet, but we'll keep you informed of that as the months develop here. For the next agenda, as I said, we'll probably continue walking through these sites, so we'll have Kenilworth, Navy Yard, maybe JBAB, and then we might also, and I'll have to talk to Mr. Pinkney or Dr. Pinkney about this, we'll probably talk about the mussel study. We had a little overview of that, I think, about a half a year ago, and maybe UMBC will talk about the passive sampler study that all links in with this question of how these tributaries are or are not contributing to our loadings in the Anacostia.
And
so that's what we're thinking.
To have that meeting at the Arboretum, mm-hmm. if you want to get a walk through a Springhouse Run.
That's an idea.
Just on October 14th is the Festival of the Rio Anacostia up at Bladensburg Park for the day, and we're working on again, a number of the people, folks in the room are working on that particular outreach into the Latino community.
Okay. Okay. Anything else? Yep.
Question relating to your comment on the schedule for the feasibility study. What's the status of the phase two remedial investigation? Will we be seeing a report about the third act in that fairly soon?
Yeah, I think it's going to come out at the same time, pretty much.
In January 2018.
That's why we got to show them.
Thanks.
All right, I think we're adjourned for this meeting.
All right, everybody, thank you very much. That was a very tight meeting. Good, good presentation. Is that the charge that battery?